Hello and welcome back to the Weekly Pulse Podcast. I'm Jeff Snyder. I'm the founder of the Morning Pulse and your host for the next 60 plus minutes as we go around the globe to analyze the issues in retirement, the markets, technology, personal finance, healthcare, so much more. We've got another great show for you this week. We're going to be joined by Rivka Liss Levinson. She makes her return to the show to discuss some recent research from the Center for State and Local Government Excellence on auto enrollment. You're not going to want to miss this. And of course, we're going to hear from our great all-stars on all the issues of the day. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this great episode of The Weekly Pulse. Yeah. Well, let's kick things off with a look at the latest social media trends. And joining me on the line from San Francisco, California, the lovely Bay Area, he is the senior finance editor for LinkedIn, Mr. Devin Banerjee, CFA. Hey, Devin, how are you?
I'm doing great, Jeff. Trying to stay dry in this Bay Area rain. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's a little bit nicer here in New York, but not by much. A little cooler today, a little overcast. It's Friday, as the audience knows that we're doing this. And so I hope things get better for you if you're going to be in the Bay Area over the weekend. Enjoy yourself and have some nice sunny days.
Thanks.
Yep. So what's top of mind this week? Obviously, lots going on. Job numbers I saw, I don't want to steal your thunder. So, what are you all tracking here on LinkedIn?
Yeah, definitely a diverse set of stories and conversations that we highlighted this week. The first, which is kind of a plug for something we do every year, but it does get a lot of attention. We unveiled our list of the top 50 companies in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And this is an entirely data-driven list. It's looking at the proportion of views on job listings on LinkedIn, the proportion of views of executive teams of certain companies, and it's all normalized for company size and all that. And so I'll just give you a peek into the list. Technology companies, big tech companies, have historically dominated the top of the list. We saw that again this year with Alphabet, the parent company of Google, coming in at number one. Mm. Facebook actually number two, Amazon number three, Salesforce number four, and Deloitte number five. Now, the list goes on to 50 names, so I would encourage you to take a list of that. But a couple of takeaways we saw, I think the overarching takeaway is that a lot of these companies have been in the headlines for not great reasons in the past year. So I mentioned Facebook in there at number two. Also, five big banks on the list in the top 50. I wrote an article about that this week. I mean, these were banks like Wells Fargo, which is obviously going through a real cultural challenge after its fake accounts, scandal. Goldman Sachs was on there, which had some headline issues a couple in the past year. But so our overarching takeaway was really that a lot of these big companies are still the fundamental training grounds and sort of stops on the resume for smart, ambitious people, despite the headline risk, And so a lot of times it's easy to simplify what we see in the headlines. And this is kind of difficult for me to say as a journalist, but sometimes headlines are overblown and they might apply to one group of a company, one division of a company, one team at a company. But these companies are tens of thousands of people, in some cases hundreds of thousands of people, and they're still the go-to training grounds for a lot of young, smart, ambitious people. So interesting list, some interesting takeaways. My team wrote a bunch of articles with the takeaways, so definitely would encourage you to take a look at that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would agree that it's a great training ground, and I think you should paint people with broad brush. Because people at the top misbehave doesn't mean people at the middle and lower levels of the organization are underperforming. I mean, so I think there's skills. I guess my point is that there's skills to be gained and learned, and don't paint people just because they're through association.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I will say the next topic I'm going to touch on, which is getting a lot of attention on social media, it is kind of painting a lot of people with a broad brush, but it's about the Gen Z economy. So these are the Gen Z workforce. So these are people typically born 1997 or after. So they're just now graduating college, entering the workforce, and companies, employers, also investors, also marketers and advertisers, everyone is trying to figure out, again, with a broad brush, but trying to figure out what these people want, what they need, what they need, what their preferences are. So you and I have talked a lot in the past from the employer perspective about what this new young workforce looks for. That is, you know, strong brand loyalty, brands that wear their values on their sleeve, you know, executives and corporate leaders who display values and who stand for something, et cetera. But we featured this Bloomberg report about how investors are trying to figure out this new economy, this new Gen Z economy. And so that includes things like, you know, obviously online research and shopping for both goods and services is just the default. You just assume that everyone entering the economy now goes first to online channels to look for goods and services. You know, marketers and advertisers are studying how these young people look to influencers, quote unquote, you know, social media influencers that stand for brands and for companies. So just a really interesting report. We're seeing a lot of conversation around it, people weighing in from the investment side, from the marketing and advertising side, from the human resources side. And so, you know, it's difficult to paint this new young workforce with a broad brush, but these are going to be, you know, the people who are our employees, who are our customers, who are our end users, our target users. And so definitely worth, you know, studying this new group of people.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. You know, we had some conversations a while back about Fyre Festival. And
yeah.
You mentioned what clued me into this was the social influencers.
Yeah.
Does this Gen Z group think differently about social influencers versus millennials? But, you know, just any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we're just seeing a higher proportion of the Gen Z universe attached to social media than the millennial universe. You know, the millennial universe now includes, I think, people who are up to almost 40 years old, and not to generalize, but, you know, obviously fewer of them are attached daily to social media as this new Gen Z ecosystem is. And so I think the Gen Z universe is still very attached to social media influencers. I will mention, by the way, that this Bloomberg report talks about how entities that are working on saving and investing and retirement products also need to study this universe and think about how to educate people through new channels, through video is the first one, and then through social media channels, because these people aren't, you know, going to their mailbox and opening a flyer from a retirement provider, or they're not even watching cable TV and seeing ads there. And so, it's actually a really important topic to think about how these people are going to be educated, because as you and I have talked about, you don't really learn this stuff in school, unfortunately. And so a lot of retirement services providers are thinking about how to reach this universe as well.
Yeah. And there, I mean, it's what's interesting is they were just working really hard to figure out the millennials, and now here comes Gen Z. And I don't think they figured out millennials completely. And now they got to figure out Gen Z. And, you know, historically, the financial services industry doesn't really pivot quickly. And
right.
I think that's not a secret. I don't think I'm, but I think there's a lot to learn. And I think the main lesson is what I take away is that a lot of customization, everyone is different. And you mentioned cord cutting, people like I might like Star Trek The Next Generation. My wife absolutely hates it and may want to watch Real Housewives of New York, right? And so there's customization that we all like, and maybe that's that approach needs to apply in a economic scalable fashion for financial services and others.
Absolutely. I mean, look, we're talking on a podcast right now. You spend a lot of time on really high quality videos, you know, as do we at LinkedIn. LinkedIn's a social media. I mean, all these things we wouldn't be doing even, you know, just 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And so, you know, I think people are trying to pivot, but, you know, obviously it takes time. If I have one more minute,
sure.
I just want to end on an uplifting note. This
Absolutely.
Is a report, you know, we've talked about education a lot, Jeff, and this report out from actually my colleague here at LinkedIn, George Anders, this week found that people age 30 to 70 are the fastest growing population of college students. Now, I mean, obviously that makes sense. You know, typically the 17 to 21 population isn't going to change that much, but we're finding that people aged 30 to 70 are increasingly going back to college or going to college for the first time. They now total 4.4 million U.S. college students. A lot of these people are people looking to be reskilled, to skill up, as you and I have talked about in the past, the importance of that as technical roles increase at companies, et cetera. But we're also seeing a lot of people look to college for the first time. And so, maybe when they were younger, they had to work immediately or they had to help their families financially. And now that some of them are in a better spot, they're able to look to college for the first time and maybe climb their professional career ladder. So it's just a really fascinating story. And we're actually seeing on social media a lot of people kind of adding to the story by weighing in with their own experiences. And it's just really inspirational.
Yeah. Life is a learned experience, and so people learn it all, you know, should be continuously learning and evolving and developing. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's actually, it's probably great for the universities, right? I mean, they are always looking for clientele, and there's a lot of stresses there financially. I just, you know, always worry about people taking on more debt, student loan debt, we've talked about on the show.
Right.
So, but that's obviously a good sign. People are learning and reskilling, and you're going to have to do that. And, you know, you're kind of really turning into a gig type of economy where you have to have multiple skills. You have to be able to turn on a dime, knowing how to code or knowing how to do a skill. And it's never too late to change what you are doing for a job. I mean, you can adapt, and that's part of being – you don't have to be locked into a job for 30, 40 years at the same company doing the same thing. And that is an older way of doing things, and that maybe it doesn't necessarily need to apply to folks, workers today.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Devin, always a pleasure. Thanks for giving us the skinny on what's happening on LinkedIn and social media. And enjoy San Francisco this week. And I hope the weather gets better. And enjoy the beautiful location here, because it is absolutely fabulous. It's magical.
It is. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Happy
appreciate
weekend.
It.
Bye.
You too. Bye.
Welcome back, and now it's time for our tech segment, and joining me on the line, you know her from The Motley Fool. She is a tech reporter, journalist, student, one of the great people out there, Ms. Natalie Walters. And hi, Natalie, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing great. Glad to be here.
Good, glad to have you. And our newest contributor, also a senior tech reporter, and just overall great and fun guy, Mr. Dan Klein. Hey, Dan, how are you?
I'm good. Hey there, Jeff and Natalie.
Well, hello. Thank you. Yeah. So thanks, guys, for joining us. And I want to say that last week's segment, which I titled She Said, He Said, even though there was really no conflict, and we're not anticipating any conflict, but it's nice to get lots of different perspectives, I guess, is the point. On technology. So, Dan, we'll start with you as the new contributors first, I guess. Why don't you take us through what is top of mind for you and your perspective on as a reporter for The Motley Fool?
So what surprised me the most was waking up this morning and noticing that Amazon plans to launch 3,300 low-orbit satellites to bring internet to the whole world. Mm. Now, on one hand, this is amazingly disruptive. It will bring internet to people that only know the internet from their phone and give them sort of a viable property. Two, it might give Americans and other countries with high internet penetration alternatives, and it will certainly be helpful in rural areas where there is no option other than satellite internet. On the other hand, it's a little bit dystopian to think of Amazon having 3,300 satellites flying all above us. It's kind of terrifying.
Yeah, let me say this. Natalie, I'm going to come to you in a minute, but I just want to set this up. I was recently watching the movie Antitrust. I don't know if you guys remember the movie Antitrust. Ryan Phillippe, Rachel Lee Cook, Claire Forlani, what's his name? Tim Robbins, maybe. And that was basically like a knockoff of Microsoft kind of taking over the world. And they were creating something called Synapse. And they had all these satellites orbiting and anyway, so it was to me sounds almost like that movie Antitrust.
It's a little bit Skynet from the Terminator.
Yeah. Okay. Or if you want to go there, a little dark, Skynet. Hopefully, they won't be launching nuclear bombs on us. But Natalie, what's your take on this? As someone who has been covering the segment for a long time, and you know, we always talk Amazon, Netflix, Apple. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to see a lot of companies try to do this. You know, Facebook has been working on things like this. I think Bill Gates has, and SpaceX. Sometimes when I hear these announcements, it's hard to say, you know, how quickly we'll be able to get it done and if it will be possible, if it will work. That's usually my question that comes to mind. I know Facebook has had some success with it, so it'll be interesting to see, you know, their timeline and, you know, how confident they are that they can get this done.
Yeah, let me ask this question, because the way I look at it right now, you know, you've got these internet providers, you've got the Fioses, the Xfinities. I mean, there are probably dozens, if not hundreds of or thousands of these providers out there. But organizations like Google have experimented with very fast internet in like San Francisco and other areas offering. It's just a way to kind of control the internet and take it away from the other companies like Verizon that I mentioned earlier?
Well, so I think you have to look at the idea that the companies that control the internet, at least in the US, are also among the most hated companies, and you're forced to deal with them. The average American has one choice. In some markets, you have two choices. Mm-hmm. But for example, at our home near Orlando, we could choose between Comcast, a terrible company that everybody hates, and Frontier, an even more terrible company that everybody hates. That also doesn't work that well. So if there was a third alternative, I mean, there's the expensive alternative of I could get satellite internet, which is fairly slow and pretty limited and really only an option if that's all you have to do. So yeah, I'm paying, I think we have Frontier. I'm paying Frontier $70 a month or $65 a month, something in that ballpark. And if I could give Amazon $40 a month or $25 to get something similar, I'd sign up for that in a heartbeat. Amazon has goodwill.
Yeah. And I mean, Natalie, I guess where I was going with this was, you know, it seems like the data that you can get from people connections, right? That would be very valuable, especially for a firm like Amazon. And I agree. Look, I like competition. The more, the merrier, because I think that drives costs down. It gets better product services for the consumer. But what about that data issue that we are always talking about on the show? Is that a concern for these technology companies that are going to be offering internet?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could be incredibly lucrative for Amazon and other companies that are working on projects like this, you know, to be able to provide internet to possibly full countries, you know, that were so, you know, that where internet was so sparse before could be huge for them. But yeah, also, you know, regulations in the U.S., you know, we're behind even in the U.S. with how we regulate the internet, and we're just starting to catch up on that, as we've seen in the past year. And so, especially for other countries that maybe, you know, are a bit behind in technology, they're going to have a lot of catch up to do with regulations.
Yeah, absolutely. Dan, what else is top of mind? You know, unless I want to leave this topic. I think we can have more. Well, I mean, you can certainly go back to the topic. What else is top of mind for you?
So and the other thing that's huge this week is companies that are continuing to try to deliver services that nobody wants. And the big one I saw is that Walmart and Google have teamed up so you could use the Google Assistant to order products, sort of the same way you could use Amazon Alexa to order products. The reality is only about 10% of Americans have done this, and only about half of those use it regularly. So this is something that, like, it's not that hard to go to the grocery store. It's not that hard to pull up an app and order something. I don't need to say, hey, Google, could you get me a pillow from Walmart? Like, it's not precise. And they talk a lot about, oh, well, if you say I want this brand of milk, eventually it will learn that's the brand of milk you want. What happens when the next week I don't want that brand of milk? It just seems like this is technology that solves a problem that doesn't exist.
Yeah. How do you see it, Nat?
Yeah, it's funny. When I was reading about that story, I was thinking about what Dan would say, and I figured he would say that because it's kind of similar to what we were discussing last week. And I agree. I was reading about this and I was thinking I would never, ever use this. It kind of just is inconvenient and makes it more trouble than just doing it yourself. You know, I've never wanted a computer to make a list for me or to order my groceries. It's much easier to just do it yourself. And as Dan said, you know, your grocery list changes all the time, or maybe you go to the grocery store, you see something else you like, or you decide, oh, well, this one's on sale, I'll get this. It's just not convenient. And I think another thing is that I never really associate Walmart with being super high tech, you know, even though they've been working on adding technology and really focusing on grocery sales. If I ever did want my grocery delivery to be high tech, you know, to have a high tech grocery experience, I would definitely think Amazon first. I just feel like they have more experience with that. And, you know, Alexa is huge and their voice assistants are great. And so I would go to Amazon first. But even then, I don't even want Amazon to handle my groceries. I can do it fine myself.
No, and I use Instacart. I live in a building, as we've talked about before. So you can go into Instacart and pull up your last order, and you could use that as the basis for your next order. But even with all the data they have, all the shopping they've done, they've actually gone to a fairly low-tech solution. So if you put in an item that's likely to be sold out, it will then show you alternatives so they don't have to interact with you. Hey, I want a pound and a quarter of ground beef. If they don't have that, would you like grapes? Like, it's not, and you go, no, I don't want grapes. How about chicken instead? So it's a very low-tech solution. And I honestly think there's some things, and Amazon has kind of proven this. Do you remember the dash button? You could put a button next to your washer dryer that you hit it and it reorders Tide, or put it in the bathroom and you hit it and it reorders shampoo. Like, and there was the Amazon wand, which as you threw something away, you could scan the barcode and it would reorder it. It's just not that hard to have a whiteboard in the kitchen where you write things down, or to know, hey, when I go to the grocery store, I'm probably going to need toilet paper. Like, that's something that gets used up. I probably need paper towels and milk and orange juice and whatever the things I buy are. Again, I'm all in favor of technology. I use my Alexa for everything from listening to music to listening to podcasts. I don't need it to do all of these other things. And I don't think that's being a Luddite. I think some things aren't made better by technology.
Wow. I think you guys really knocked that one out of the park. You know, I would just say, I just kind of view Alexa and those other tools as, to your points, just listening to music. I've never even considered ordering a pizza through – we don't have Alexa, but I've never even considered it. I just have viewed it like a giant speaker. And, you know, I really don't want to – I don't have a problem getting up and turning the light off. I mean, or turning the TV off, or, you know, maybe saying, hey, why don't you play The Grateful Dead from 1972, Alexa. That might be cool. But I agree. I mean, I don't know. I think it's kind of lazy. I don't know. It just feels lazy to me.
It's not so much a question of lazy as – it's like when people have a nickname that's longer than their regular name.
Yeah.
Like, right. Well, like it's not shortening it. It's not making it easier. And I'm sure there's things my Amazon Echo could do. Like, I use it as a timer because my microwave is kind of hard to use because some of the buttons don't work anymore. So, like, I'm sure there's five other things like that I would find very valuable that it does. But the problem is it does 50,000 things. There's a Motley Fool tool where you can look up stock prices. I have no idea how that works, and we work at the Motley Fool.
Yeah. Well, I think the best thing that came out of – I mean, it was great back and forth, and this is why I love this segment. I think the audience does too, because you get a diverse set of opinions, but you guys are really good about nailing it. I think you nailed it with the title, which is a case of offering products that no one wants, Google and Walmart working together on a shopping assistant. So be prepared to see that on Sunday morning as one of the tags for this show. Guys, we're going to have to leave it there. Awesome, awesome segment. And hope you guys have a great weekend wherever you may be. And we'll catch you up with you next week.
See you next week.
Bye, guys.
Thank you. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Give me the microphone first so I can bust like a bubble. Compton and Long Beach together. Now you know you in trouble because ain't nothing but a G-bang, baby. Welcome back, everyone. Time for the markets segment. Joining me on the line, the lead anchor for the TD Ameritrade Network, Mr. Oliver Rennick, and the chief executive officer for Delphi Digital, Mr. Kevin Kelly, who is now a TV and movie star. Guys, welcome to the show.
Hey, yo.
Hey.
TV. Well,
all I can say is I got the green M&Ms. I don't know what it was like going on TD Ameritrade Network, but on this show, you know, we'll cater to you. Get green M&Ms if you want them. And I heard you like Snickers, so we had them in the green room. So, Kevin, let's start with you. We always, you know, we always give you the advantage with Oliver starting. But I think what I'd like to do is give Oliver the advantage to kind of add some pieces around what you've got to say, given what's going on in the network. So why don't you take us through job numbers this week, everything that's going on. We'll get Oliver's response, and then we'll do a little digging into crypto, because I know you were really big on the TV scene this week on crypto.
Yeah, no, I'll tee us up here. I mean, starting with jobs, obviously kind of the big number that came out this morning. You know, it was definitely a good report. You know, you kind of had this rebound back from a week, couple months, whether that was seasonal issues or, you know, you had some upward revision. So I think, you know, if you again look at the longer term trend, I mean, there's nothing really too concerning about the labor market. Jobless rate, you know, staying pretty much right in line with where it's been. And typically, I mean, what you tend to see prior to, you know, recessions, and we've talked about a mild yield curve inversion that happened, you know, earlier this year. You know, when you look at the kind of the job market, you typically tend to see that jobless rate, or at least the 12-month moving average, you know, kind of trend upwards. We really haven't seen that yet. So nothing too concerning there. But no, I mean, I think it's kind of one of these, you know, risk on rallies that people were a bit skeptical of, you know, probably the last, you know, 2 months or so. You got the S&P pushing towards, I think, you know, 2,900 on the tape, but, you know, as we're speaking now, broke above its prior, you know, January 2018 high. You had some technical indicators like a golden cross with a 50-day moving average jumping above its 200-day. So a lot of kind of bullish sentiment, you know, surrounding stocks, including the rebound in some of these cyclical sectors. So I think, you know, if you looked at what happened or how this rebound, you know, kind of ricocheted, you had, you know, stocks moving higher. You also had gold moving higher. You had a bit of a rally in the dollar. And now you're starting to see, you know, gold has kind of faded away, you know, since 6 weeks ago or so, as stocks have continued to rage on. So it seems like, you know, people are starting to get a little bit more, I'll say, confident in the rally, or that this might actually be a bit of a sustainable, you know, rally higher. Maybe you could push towards new highs. Whereas, you know, I think, you know, even a month ago or a couple months ago, people were still a bit skeptical about, you know, how sustainable this rally was, or how fundamentally driven it was. And so I'll defer to Oliver, because, you know, he's obviously got his hand in this every single day, but that's kind of where I'm seeing things.
Yeah. Oliver, go ahead, Ollie. I was going to say, before you start, I got to say that for the last, I don't know, 6, 8, 9, 10, 12 months, whatever it is, we've been talking recession, not you guys, but people have been talking down the economy, and it just seems, you know, with these latest job numbers, very resilient. But anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt. That's just my little interpretation.
Yeah, no, you're totally right, because that's really what people are grappling with. I think Kevin did a pretty good job of describing sort of the nature of how the market leadership has changed and shifted and all that type of stuff. You know, we just kind of are able to thread this needle where markets are responding positively to an economy that is maybe sort of on the brink and maybe just in a little bit of a patch of slowness like we've seen before. This has happened several times throughout the bull market, 2011, 2015, namely. So it's not unprecedented to, you know, see some earnings declines and see some economic figures dip into negative territory, or even, you know, bond yields around the world dip into negative territory. This, you know, just happened a couple of years back. So there are plenty of sort of reasons to think that, you know, we will move through this patch of slowness like we did in the past. But that being said, just from covering the market, I think that it is a very sharp sort of knee-jerk response to what the Fed has said in terms of how investors are buying up stocks, because they are also looking at sort of a formula that's worked many times, but the companies that have been a big part of that formula are, I think, really in a bit of a different place, and that is namely some of the very high-growth tech names, which if you notice, since the market corrected and sold off for NASDAQ bear market in December, a lot of those companies are not back at the highs. There are plenty of companies in the market that are going to new highs. A lot of software companies, a lot of companies with high margins, a lot of companies with clear cash flow visibility and big client bases in the U.S. specifically. Some of these big international tech companies are still have some proving to do. We see Amazon going head-to-toe with Apple, head-to-toe with Alphabet, head-to-toe with Roku, and, you know, it's basically there's just all these different tech companies now that are kind of going after a similar pie, Apple competing with Netflix. You know, you can find all kinds of iterations. So that makes a little bit more of a tricky environment. So far, those companies have always been a great reward to investors. So it's just, I think, an old habit that is might pay off again, but certainly is a little bit more dubious, I think, this time around in terms of the nature of what kind of participation the market needs to keep up what it's already had since December.
Thanks, Oliver. Kevin, you made the rounds this week on TV, featured on the TD Ameritrade Network. Maybe not featured, but you were definitely on the TD Ameritrade Network. I don't know if you were the only guest.
Oh, he was featured.
I was gonna walk that back, but apparently I was actually right on that. And then you were on another network, and then you actually appeared on the Morning Pulse Academy. So you have got your TV chops this week, and you're probably, who knows, you'll probably be on Good Morning America tomorrow morning. let's talk a little crypto. You know, Bitcoin rally, regulation. Give us the skinny on that in the next 2 minutes or next minute, and give Oliver a chance to respond.
Yeah, I mean, big news this week is you finally had, you know, this kind of explosion upward in crypto asset prices. I mean, when you put this in context, it's always super important to put this all in context. You had a really big kind of week with Bitcoin jumping above, you know, 5,000, which again, from a psychological perspective, is just kind of good for anybody who's in this market. I think if we're able to trade sideways or hover around these levels, I think you're starting to get a bit of renewed interest. Just based on, you know, some of the headlines that have come out this week and just kind of the overall sentiment, it's definitely moving in the right direction. But I mean, when you put this in context, I mean, the drawdown from, you know, the price bubble back, you know, a little over a year ago now, you know, you're still sitting over 70% off those kind of all-time highs. So it is important to say, you know, we still have a long way to go. It is a long-term game when it comes to Bitcoin. You had the SEC come out this week with, you know, a bit of news or clarification around how they're going to start to, you know, or have been viewing some of these, you know, initial coin offerings or ICOs and different token structures. And to be honest with you, it's that type of scrutiny is definitely needed. And I think it's both a positive and a negative in the fact that there's a lot of projects out there that I think are still going to be under the gun over the next, you know, let's call it 12, 24, 36 months as this market continues to mature. But it's good to see, you know, starting to get some guidelines. And I think that's certainly a sign of the overall market, you know, kind of moving in the right direction towards maturity.
Oliver, what's your take? You talked this week with Kevin, but I'm sure you were also talking with other people about Bitcoin. What's your sense?
Well, I think that firstly, Kevin's team has done some really interesting work that I haven't really seen anywhere else, and that was kind of the focus of our conversation, even with the big move, was just what has been happening in terms of, you know, the market maturing and what, you know, big holders of this asset class are going to do. So I think the research has been really interesting on that. As far as the, you know, pop in prices and stuff, I still just kind of, you know, I know that people, a lot of people in the world of markets probably think I'm crazy for always discussing this, but it's just, I can't deny sort of the logic of a huge risk-on rally that is the best S&P 500 quarter, you know, in like decades, in a decade, that also comes with a little bit more risk with people buying Bitcoin too. It's just, I think it's not unreasonable to follow that logic and think it suggests something. That's kind of my inclination, sort of my Occam's razor explanation for it. Otherwise, who knows why Bitcoin does what it does.
Yeah. Hey, Oliver, just real quick, do you expect that that Kevin will have his own show within the next week, like, you know, Crypto with Kevin or something like that?
I don't see why not.
Well, Kevin,
I'm willing to make a sizable prop bet on that.
Yeah, Kevin.
We'll put it in the works.
What's that?
So we'll put it in the works.
All right. Well, guys, I want to thank you so much for your spending a couple of minutes of your more than a couple minutes of your time. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you soon next week. Bye, guys.
Give me the microphone first so I can bust like a bubble. Compton and Long Beach together. Now you know you in trouble because ain't nothing but a G-bang, baby.
Welcome back. And we're going to welcome back to our show a very special guest. Rivka List-Levinson is the Director of Research at the Center for State and Local Government Excellence. Hey, Rivka, how are you?
Hey, Jeff, doing well. How are you?
Welcome back to the program, and so happy you could join us. It's awesome, and so glad you could join us. You and the center just released a study a little over a month ago, maybe a little bit less, late March, I guess, on perceptions of auto-enrollment, but not just auto-enrollment in the corporate world or the tax-exempt world. This is a study that you did on public sector workers. So thanks for joining us. Why don't you take us through the results? Really interesting and fascinating. I've done some of the reading about it, but want to hear from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
Sure. So just to take a step back for a minute, as you mentioned, you know, in the private sector, auto enrollment into 401k plans is pretty common practice. But when it comes to the public sector, so we're talking here about, you know, the teachers who are educating our kids and the public safety workers who are keeping our streets safe, this isn't really the case. It's not available nearly as much. And so what we wanted to do is kind of a deep dive into understanding what public sector employees think about auto enrollment and whether that's something that they're open to. So we did the study, a survey of 400 state and local government workers to check in on their attitudes about auto enrollment into supplemental retirement plans. And one of the main things we found is that a majority of respondents, 77%, said that if they were auto enrolled into a supplemental retirement plan, that they would stay.
Yeah, that's I mean, I think that's amazing. And so before we get into that statistic, I want to just talk about the pool of survey recipients or people that you queried. I mean, these are, I would imagine, police, firefighters, workers who, you know, work on roads, who do transit work, who do water work throughout the entire United States. I just want to paint this picture for the audience of, you know, we're not just talking about one geographic area or one particular pension system.
No, we are talking a nationally representative survey of state and local government workers, as you said, all different geographic regions, all different industry types, all different education levels, incomes. So it really ran the gamut.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think this number of 77% is really important, because having worked in the public sector for the last decade, meaning myself as a consultant, you know, I know that they're an advisor. I know that there have been a lot of pushback in terms of auto enrollment. I think we're going to get to that in a little bit. The biggest pushback, whether it's the tax exempt world or the corporate world, 401k, 403b, that you often get is, you know, why the paternalism and why are you doing this on my behalf? I didn't ask you to do this. And then the CFO, the finance director, the person in charge of the money, will say, there's more match. I've got to give a match. So that's generally been the pushback. But and then just to frame it up for another 30 seconds, in the public sector, you have the additional layer of these wonderful DB plans, which are under attack from outside influences, and people say, why do you have a DB plan? Blah blah blah. But you know, that's an important component to the retirement benefit. And people will say, well, they already have this DB plan. Why would we want to have a supplemental benefit? So,
it's a really good point you bring up. And with the DB plans, you know, as you said, there are many public sector workers that do have DB plans. But since the Great Recession, more and more, there have been switches over to more traditional, you know, kind of a defined contribution 401k type plan in the public sector, or some sort of hybrid plan that's a combination. And more the responsibility for saving is being shifted from the employer to the employee. So it's becoming more and more important for employees to be able to, you know, understand how to save for retirement. And it's not just something where it's something that's automatically done for them through a traditional DB plan.
Yeah. And I should mention that there's also still laws in the books. I don't know if you talked about this in the survey, because it, you know, you're really dealing with participants, but there's these anti-garnishment laws that exist today that prevent a lot of auto enrollment. Although I would imagine a lot of that has been lifted in some of these states that you indicated have adopted these auto features or moving to a defined contribution retirement plan.
Yeah, I mean, we're finding right now maybe about 10 states that state retirement plans that are working with auto enrollment. And I think, you know, there may be more that are considering this given. So, for example, we did a study last year with the South Dakota retirement system, and they implemented auto enrollment. So before they implemented auto enrollment, they had 3% of their employees were participating in the supplemental retirement plan. And after they implemented it, that number spiked to 90%.
Wow.
So when you see studies like that, I think there are other states, as you said, there are some legal issues, but I think there are other states that are going to be considering this. And so we really wanted to look at how is it that employees are feeling about this, should it be possible.
Yeah, I think plan sponsors, you know, employers, government entities can take note of this because I think it's a great way to boost the supplemental, and the key word here is supplemental. No one's advocating for not the center, not the sponsors. No one here is advocating for the diminishment of a benefit. But if it's a way to bolster a retirement savings for people, I think it's a possibility that should be evaluated. And I am an advocate. You know, I have focused the last 10 years on tax exempt and government. But I'm an advocate of learning from different areas of the marketplace, different sectors of the economy. And this is working for places like South Dakota, for Wyoming, which is another example. You know, Polly Scott at Wyoming, they've implemented auto enrollment. I think it's worth taking a look at and considering.
And one of the things, you know, you had mentioned kind of this concern about kind of a paternalistic element to this. And I think one thing that we saw in our survey results is, and that you kind of hear is there seems to be some misperception about what auto enrollment means. It doesn't mean that you have to be enrolled at that amount. It means that the default option is that you're enrolled, but that you have the option of either staying in the plan or opting out of the plan. So it's not that it's forcing people to be in the plan. It's just changing what the automatic is and what kind of the default option. So I think, you know, we did see some misunderstanding when people said, you know, who are against auto enrollment, well, this should be a decision that's under the employee's control, not the employer. And it is under the employee's control. It's just, you know, changing that from the default being you are not part of this to the default being you are part of this.
Yeah, it's very different than Social Security, which some government workers are eligible for. There are some state and local government workers who don't have the ability of Social Security. But I think, you know, we've talked about this with you and others on the show. We do a horrible job in this industry with jargon. You know, the simple fact that people do not understand what auto enrollment means that auto enrollment just doesn't make sense. Maybe that's the name that doesn't make sense to people. And we need to do a better job of explaining these things. And, you know, if we do that, we're going to get people in general, because we're really worried about people, not necessarily the employers, although the employer sponsoring retirement plans is a key aspect of saving. But we really want people to understand what they're doing. Auto enrollment, auto escalation, all these auto features are very important. But if they're not educated and don't know how to take advantage of these things and all the things that are available to them from through the employer or through government, you know, I think they're not going to be as well off.
Yeah, and we did look at auto escalation as well to see what employees thought about that. And interestingly, there seems to be more of an appetite, at least right now, for auto enrollment than for auto escalation.
Yeah, I could.
So that's something also that, you know, employers might want to think about when they're, you know, trying to decide what to do.
Yeah, I think baby steps. I think one thing we've learned from the private sector and the tax exempts, you know, 403B world, baby steps matter, making these huge jumps. And this is, you know, it's really interesting because 2006 was the Pension Protection Act, right? And that was that created the QDIA and the auto enrollment features and led to the implementation of some of the things that behavioral economists have been telling us for a long time. most notably Richard Thaler, Shlomo Benarti,
yep.
John Joy. I mean, I can go down the list. There are many of great ones, so I don't want to single anybody out.
You've named some good ones.
I got it down. I have them all down. Well, you should hear my imitations. But I think that, what we've learned is that incremental change is more of an – people have an appetite for that. And I would just say that I agree with what you're fundamentally saying is that people – or what their your findings are is I would expect that people like change, but they want managed incremental change.
Well, so it's sort of interesting you say that because I think, one of the things we found, given that there's more of a desire for auto enrollment than for auto escalation, I might argue the opposite on this one. And that, in some ways, it seems like people may want you to kind of rip off the Band-Aid.
Oh.
So it seems like people are not loving the idea of auto escalation, where you're starting at a rate and then, slowly raising it. But we found that one of the things we did in the study was we gave hypotheticals to the different participants. We split them into four groups and gave hypothetical default deferral rates. And what we found is that people were very much willing to kind of stay with or increase the rate that they were given, no matter what the rate was. And so one thing that, it makes me think about is is it that for folks that it is, a better option to kind of start them a little bit higher maybe than what public sector employers are doing rather than starting, let's say, at a 1% rate and slowly raising it to 4%?
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, I stand corrected, and I think you're looking at the actual data. I think I was just making the case that between the distinction between auto enrollment escalation, I'm in agreement. I think that if you can get auto enrollment in place, that's a really good first step. And then over time, it seems to be just because of the DB pension and maintaining that benefit that supplemental plans don't move as quickly in the public sector as we do in the corporate and these other segments. And so I'm in agreement with you.
No, I think you're right.
Yeah. So, Rivka, I'm going to post a link to your very important research or the organization's research.
Wonderful.
What's coming down the pike in terms of some additional research, just so our audience knows some of the future work for the center?
Sure. So one thing that I do want to just mention is that we are going to be having a webinar to go through and discuss the results of this study. So if you're interested in hearing more details about what we found, if you go to slge.org to the events page, we'll be having Wednesday, May 7th at 2 p.m. a webinar to discuss the findings. And there you should also check out an upcoming summit on the Public Sector Workforce 2030 that we'll be holding in Fort Lauderdale in September of 2019.
Wow. Well, that's great. We're looking forward to the webinar. It's actually the day before my birthday, so what a great way to celebrate.
Perfect.
I'm going to be 47. It's hard to believe. I still think of myself as 18, and I had the maturity of a 10-year-old. But Rivka, always a pleasure talking to you. We're going to look forward to more research from the center, from you and the team, and wish you a great weekend, and we'll check back with you soon.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Give me the microphone first so I can bust like a bubble. Compton and Long Beach together. Now you know you in trouble because ain't nothing but a G-bang, baby.
Too low, that breeze, so we're crazy. Welcome back, and now it's time for our Millennial Money segment, and joining us from his book tour, and we're going to find out exactly where he's been touring the United States in support of his book, Financial Freedom, Mr. Grant Sabatier, the founder of Millennial Money. Hey, Grant.
Hey, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing well. And I just want to say before we started, I did see your segment on Rachel Ray, and that was awesome. Congratulations.
Cool, man.
And I saw it online and looked like it was a lot of fun. And looked like you kind of schooled the audience, so that was cool too.
Thanks, man.
So tell me in the audience, it's not just me, but tell us where might you be this weekend? Where are you the weekend?
So this week I'm going to be in San Francisco. I have an event at Stanford University tomorrow. So if you live in the San Francisco Bay Area, want to come down to Palo Alto, come hang out with us. You can find more at financialfreedombook.com/tour for those dates. And there's a couple other things going on in the Bay Area this weekend, and then head up to Portland, Oregon next week. And so I'm deep in the California portion of the tour. I'm sitting in beautiful sunshine right now, outside Ventura, California. And so stop by San Francisco this weekend.
Now, are you posting photos on Instagram, on Twitter? How are you kind of sharing your journey?
Yeah, so everything is on Instagram. It's the username @financialfreedom. And so you can follow the tour there and see pictures from all the events that I'm posting.
Awesome. So let's talk a little bit about last time you were on, which is about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, you gave some insight. You know, you had just begun the first leg of your tour. You were going to head out west, which is obviously where you've wound up. But what have you learned over the past 2 weeks? What's been, you know, top of mind, thought provoking as you're engaging with folks, not just millennials, but folks at universities, at bookstores, talking about the book and their thoughts on financial freedom and literacy.
Yeah. So I think generally people are hopeful and excited. I'm seeing more people than ever before who are starting side hustles and launching income streams on the side in like a bunch of really creative, fun ways. And so there's so many different ways to monetize your hobbies and your side hustles that's really exciting. More people just aren't waiting for that next promotion in their full-time job. They're going out and, you know, being proactive about earning more money and getting creative. And then also more people are starting to, I think, define success for themselves and realize that, you know, even just having 6 months to a year of expenses in the bank gives you so much freedom in your life. And then if you don't like your job, but you saved up, you know, a little bit of money, life's too short to stay in that job you don't like. So before, even 2 or 3 years ago, when I saw more people afraid to leave their full-time job and do something else, I see more people than ever before just even in the middle of their careers, you know, 25, 26 years old, saving up, you know, a year or two of expenses and then taking a break and traveling or figuring out what they want to do next, as opposed to just kind of climbing the corporate ladder, which is it's cool to see people getting more comfortable with and having less fear around, you know, living lives that they love.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. We're about a week out or a week in it'll be a week on Monday by the time this airs from tax day. And, you know, I don't have the music queued up, but, you know, like something like dun, 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 right? Any thoughts on, are you hearing anything about taxation, about taxes, people paying taxes, fear about paying taxes, the changes in the tax law? Does that come up at all during the Millennial Money and the Power of Financial Freedom conversations you're having?
No, not at all. I mean, I think a lot of people I know, they've already done their taxes. Most of them are getting refunds. And so, no, taxes in the short term don't come up often. Tax-efficient investing definitely comes up a lot, you know, when you're thinking about just the long term. You know, am I investing in my 401k account the right way? Am I investing in my other accounts the right way? So I think most millennials are keeping the long-term view and not stressing too much about taxes right now.
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly see that. You know, I think for me, you know, it's always a stressful time of the year. Not because, you know, just in general, like, figuring out if you're going to get a refund, if you're going to have to pay more taxes. And then certainly dealing with a change like we had last year, that kind of changes things. And you don't know how, you know, people don't like change. And I have to admit that sometimes when it comes to this kind of stuff, I don't like change either. But, yeah, I think you kind of deal with it, I guess. That's what we have to do. So on your journey, I want to break down a little bit to the personal, because I think you do a great job of sharing a lot about yourself. Tell us about some of your non-financial freedom, non-book tour related adventures. I mean, have you seen some great sights? Have you had some good food? You know, give us a little bit of a journey there.
Yeah. So one of the best things about this whole trip that I didn't expect, you know, I've done tons of bookstores, high schools, all different types of events. Yesterday, I spent the entire day with a documentary film crew filming on the beach and out in the mountains. But the most unexpected thing is just living in a van, you know, kind of forces you to live in a very different way, at least than I was accustomed. And so life is so much simpler. You know, you get up, you make sure the van's running well, you take care of the van, you take care of yourself. You don't have that many choices. And really, you're much more connected to the world because, you know, the weather impacts where you're going to drive. You know, where you're going to sleep is a big consideration. Last night, I slept literally 10 feet from the Pacific Ocean, right along the water. Incredibly beautiful, you know, only a couple miles north of, you know, those $10 million Malibu properties. I'm, you know, camped for last night. It was actually free, but usually, you know, it's only 20, 30 bucks. And so it's incredible how rich of an experience you can have in life for such little money. And I think that's been the biggest surprise for me. I really think, you know, I'm not going to test myself on this, but I think you can live a really amazing life on like $5,000 a year. You know, you have to be mobile. You want to travel, but especially when you're young doing that, you know, I was thinking, I was like, literally this view tonight cost me $20 and someone a mile down the road, you know, they bought a $10 million house for this view. And I get to pick up and move my camper, my living room to another beautiful view tomorrow. So a lot of those things were, you know, really unexpected. Just, I'm a big fan of putting myself in life situations that are very different than I've experienced before, just to see what I can learn and what, you know, how I'm going to react. And man, I got to tell you, I am much, much more fond of the van life than I expected. I am 34. I turned 35 later in December of this year. I don't know if this is something I could do, you know, forever, but I could easily spend a year or two on the road. And that's something I never would have thought I could say.
Yeah, it's almost like I was watching a video last night on YouTube. I think a lot of people do that. They spend time on YouTube watching videos, and someone, it was like the RV life. I forget exactly what it was called. But really interesting, and I think you can learn a lot about yourself. We tend to have, especially in America, we tend to have, you know, we live in homes. We have pretty much traditional standard lives, I would say, at least. I mean, I can't speak for everyone, but I do at least. And I think you're kind of buffered, but I think that kind of gives you an authentic experience. And a lot of people, especially retirees, choose to go out on and buy an RV and kind of tour the U.S. and do that. And by the way, some of the RVs that I've seen online, they're better than some of the homes I've been in. So, I mean, you know, let's just say that there are a lot of creature comforts, but no, I think it's amazing, and I think, you know, you actually get to experience life in a different way, and I think that's really exciting for you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about learning and growing, and, you know, I often think in America we just chase ease and convenience.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things you see so many people now. It's like, you know, it's pretty easy to make decent money and, you know, get a decent apartment and get your food delivered within 2 hours, but, you know, I don't think that ease and convenience are the pathway to growth. And it's the paradox, I think, in life is that we try to control all of our time and try to make things as easy as possible, when in reality, it's often those things that surprise us or that we least expect or that we stumble on that make us feel most alive. And so I'll leave you with that one, Jeff. That's what I'm thinking about on the road.
That's very philosophical. You got to, and this is what I love about Grant. Not only can we talk about financial freedom and money, but we can also talk about philosophy, because that was what he studied, right? You studied that at the University of Chicago.
Yeah, I was a philosophy major. I think too much generally, Jeff, but I think the insights on the road are that sometimes in life, not knowing where you're going to be, where you're going to sleep tonight, what you're going to eat, who you're going to meet, that can actually be a really beautiful thing.
Living in the moment. And there he is, Grant Sabatier, out on his Financial Freedom Book Tour. You can check him out, as he said, financialfreedombook.com. Grant, it's great talking with you, and enjoy the book tour. We look forward to catching up with you very, very soon, my friend.
All right, thanks, Jeff. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Compton and Long Beach together. Now you know you in trouble, cause ain't nothing but a G-bang, baby. Too low, death free, so we're crazy. Death row is the label that
welcome back, and now it's time for our personal finance slash retirement segment. And joining me on the line, we've got Mr. Jacob Passy. He's a personal finance reporter with MarketWatch, and we have a retirement reporter, or the retirement reporter for MarketWatch, Ms. Alessandra Melito. Hey guys, how are you?
Doing well, and you?
I'm doing okay. Yeah, it's a kind of a hazy, overcast Friday, but hopefully it'll be a nice weekend. I'm hoping things warm up eventually. Thanks for joining us on the line. Jacob, I'll start with you. What's been top of mind for you and the folks at MarketWatch as it relates to personal finance?
Yeah, so I did a story this week based on a survey from Compare Cards, which is a subsidiary of LendingTree. And the survey looked at basically questions people ask their credit card companies about getting better terms, such as, you know, higher credit limit or lower APR on their credit cards or other things. And what the survey found is that people aren't asking these questions enough. And when they do, but when they do, I should say, they are actually very successful in getting what they want. So the survey found, in particular, the survey found that women were far less likely than men to ask their credit card issuer for more leniency or better terms. For instance, 25% of male cardholders had asked their credit card company for a lower APR versus just 16% of women. Or, you know, when it comes to a late fee, 55% of men had asked for it to be waived in the past year versus 43% of women. So you know, overall, though, you know, the survey found that very few people are asking some of these questions. You know, only 1 in 5 cardholders are asking to reduce the interest rate on their card. Less than half of people who had incurred a late fee have asked for it to be waived. And, you know, part of that comes down to the fact that people probably just don't even know that you can ask these questions. I mean, obviously, you know, with something like an APR, that only matters if you are carrying a balance on your credit card, which you should obviously avoid doing to avoid paying interest. But, you know, that's something that all of us find ourselves dealing with from time to time when you make major purchases or, you know, have a, you know, a wedding or something like that. You may put a lot of stuff on your credit card. It's a common experience, and it's just kind of good to keep in mind because, you know, as the report from Compare Cards kind of laid out, you know, this can, you know, asking these questions can really save you a lot of money. So, like, for instance, a consumer with a $5,000 balance on their credit card, if they go from having an APR of 24% to an APR of 18%, that would save them over $450 in interest payments. So it really adds up. And you know, it's just kind of, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I also feel like people get nervous about these kinds of questions. You don't want to ask the wrong question, but there's really no wrong question here. You know, the worst that happens is your credit card company doesn't change anything.
Yeah.
The best that happens is they do and you save money.
Yeah. I think I agree with you. I think I don't see it more of a gender. I don't see it as a gender thing. I think it's like just people being proactive or not knowing the right questions to ask. I think all of us need to educate ourselves on all the financial instruments we're using. And I think it just behooves us all to take a look at the contracts. And I think at this point, you know, living in New York, I don't know if you feel the same way, but you kind of, everything's negotiable. So you got to ask the right questions.
Totally.
And if you don't advocate on behalf of yourself, my experience is that not many people will do that. So you've got to take the initiative. That's just my, whatever, 2 cents or a cent at this point. Well, thanks for that, Jacob. And Allie, as the retirement reporter, what's been top of mind for you and MarketWatch this week?
So I did a story on healthcare costs and how they're continuing to rise. Fidelity every year comes out with this report that looks at what a couple who is both 65 years old would need in retirement for healthcare expenses. And this year, that couple would need, if they were to retire this year, they would need $285,000 in retirement for healthcare alone. And Fidelity makes a couple of assumptions. So they're expecting you to live for a couple more decades. And they're also assuming that both members of the couple are eligible for Medicare, which between Part A and Part B would cover various
expenses like hospital stays and doctor visits and lab tests and all that. But Fidelity got a little fancy this year, and they came up with other analyses. So they looked at what a single woman retiree would need, and she would need $150,000 in retirement for medical expenses alone, and a single man would need $135,000. And then they went into what a 35-year couple in retiring in 30 years, how they can save $285,000. I thought that was interesting, but even more so the fact that $285,000 today will be drastically different in 30 years when those 35-year-olds are retiring. So I just did a little calculation for the future value of $285,000. And if we're assuming a 2% inflation rate, which some people might think is conservative, some people might think is not, but regardless, that figure would be more than $500,000.
Wow.
In 30 years.
Wow.
So, and this is not including any other increases. So every year, healthcare expenses increase. Last year it was $280,000. This year it's $285,000. And a few years before that, in 2015, it was $245,000. So not even including inflation, because inflation didn't change that much in the past couple of years, you are seeing a rise in healthcare expenses. So if you are a 35-year-old retiring in 30 years, that $516,000 that you're going to need and that you need to start saving and investing for, that's just covering you for what you would need today, not including any of the other expenses. And healthcare is a weird industry that they charge a lot of money for various services. So it's just important to take into consideration. And then I also just I mentioned a little bit about how, you know, you still should start saving and, you know, putting as much as you can. And there are different vehicles to do that. Obviously, you can put money into a 401k, but when you're talking about medical expenses, you might want to consider a health savings account, which you can use as a retirement vehicle. Also, you can obviously use them for today's expenses, you know, in healthcare, but you can also use them years down the road. So that's what I did this week.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I didn't even realize, I'd seen the Fidelity number, but I didn't realize that it was not including people using Medicare. So presumably that number's a lot higher if you didn't have Medicare to provide any type of coverage. And that's just worrisome. I mean, I think you did some very conservative basic math, but healthcare expenses don't look like they're coming down anytime soon. Which is really opposite of a market economy. Usually in a market economy, you find efficiencies, right? And with these new medical innovations, you would think that over time, these procedures and things would come down in price. But you're actually seeing health costs and drug costs. I think we've talked about it in your segment before. You've seen these things kind of go up. So really disconcerting. And I know, you know, people like myself who are closer to retirement than we are at the beginning of our careers, or, you know, maybe I'm in the middle of my career, that's worrisome and just makes me say, hey, I better not stop working. That's what it tells me.
Definitely.
Well, guys, thanks so much for dropping in and sharing your insights. Certainly appreciate it. And wish you guys the best for a wonderful weekend. Hopefully the weather gets better here in New York or wherever you may be. And we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Bye, guys. Bye. Well, folks, that wraps up another great episode of the Weekly Pulse. I don't know where time goes. Do you? But I had a fun time. And special thanks to Rivka Levinson from the Center for State and Local Government Excellence for sharing very interesting research on enrollment perspectives and perceptions. Very unique, very interesting. And special thanks to our all-stars for always making time for the show. And thank you to you, our audience. Hope you enjoy the rest of your Sunday, the rest of your weekend. And we hope to see you right back here on the Weekly Pulse Podcast.